Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. In this podcast, community oncologist and haematologist Dr. Randy Bruhn and multiple myeloma expert Dr. Faith Davis discuss the value of real-world evidence in guiding treatment decisions, the available real-world evidence for elderly and frail patients with multiple myeloma, and how to optimally manage these patients in clinical practice. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Takeda Pharmaceuticals USA Incorporated and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, and welcome to this educational program. We would like to review how real-world evidence can guide the management of elderly and frail patients with multiple myeloma. I'm Dr. Randy Bruhn. I'm a medical oncologist in a private practice group in Cincinnati. I see a wide variety of patients and am joined today by Dr. Faith Davies of the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Faith?
Hi there. Yes, I'm Faith Davies. I'm a professor of medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, and I'm also the director of the Blood Cancer Center at NYU Langone Health. My special interest and passion is seeing and treating multiple myeloma patients.
Thank you. We'd like to start by looking at the value of real-world evidence supporting clinical decision-making. There's a lot of evidence available for the treatment of myeloma from randomized controlled trials, which is what oncologists in day-to-day practice rely on primarily to make decisions. Unfortunately, those trials aren't perfect. They exclude a number of populations from participating in the trial for a whole variety of reasons. Some of those include advanced age, rare molecular alterations, poor performance status, a high rate of medical comorbidities, and some healthcare disparity issues such as low socioeconomic status and rural location or living distant from an academic medical center. As a result, the rate of clinical trial ineligibility has been reported to be anywhere from 22 to 72% of real-world patients with myeloma. Additionally, in day-to-day practice, we in the field run into a number of issues that probably aren't really approached too well within controlled trials, including compliance issues, which I'm sure we're all quite familiar with, as well as rare or long-lasting adverse events, which may affect either our ability to deliver a therapy or to continue with further therapy. In fact, a review of 81 cancer therapy trials found nearly 90% scored poorly on reporting recurrent and late toxicities. The hope would be that real-world evidence studies can be used to bridge the knowledge gap and improve the evidence used in drug approvals. Faith, welcome. Would you please discuss for us how we define the meaning of real-world data and real-world evidence, and then going on, how this information is being used to influence healthcare policies and drug approvals?
Yeah, thanks, Randy. It's really important that we utilize some of the real-world data we have. And we can get that data from a number of different sources. So there are large trials, be it national registries or indeed studies which have been run by large hospitals, where they're collecting the practice of what they do on a day-to-day basis. But in addition to that, we've got evidence that we can take from medical health records, and then also evidence we can take from some of the insurance records. And so when we actually take that data and we analyze it, that's what we're really calling real world evidence. And as you mentioned earlier, it's becoming more and more important because our clinical trials really tell us whether a drug could work. Whereas when we look at this real world evidence, it's actually telling us whether the drug really does work in our day-to-day practice. And many of the health regulatory authorities are now looking at this data, particularly with respect to long-term outcomes, to side effects, and really trying to utilize, do those clinical trials really translate into everyday clinical practice?
How is that being used to influence healthcare policies and drug approvals? It seems like such uncontrolled data that it's a little difficult to work with.
Yeah, so I think to some extent, when many of the studies finish, we maybe don't pick up rare side effects or some of the long-term toxicities. And so we can often get that data from looking at these real-world data sets. But also, sometimes the patients we see in our everyday clinic, they're not those ideal patients that maybe go into clinical trials. And so we can therefore get evidence about how long a patient may be on the drug for. And this can then feed back into some of the health technology assessments around the actual utility of the drug and the costing of the drug, but also potentially in the wider context about how we sequence drugs and what the impact that can be on the larger healthcare resource.
Thank you. Which patients with myeloma tend to be excluded from randomized controlled trials, and why do you think that's the case?
So unfortunately for us, many myeloma patients really don't make it into the trials. And I think you mentioned in your introduction, depending on the clinical study we look at, it could be anywhere between 20 and 70% of patients who wouldn't be eligible for those clinical trials. And there's a large variety of reasons for this. Some of them are just purely practical, like geographical distance from a hospital that has the clinical trial. But other of them relate to the actual patient themselves. So, for instance, it may be that many of our patients, their creatinine clearance is not good enough to go into the clinical trial, or they have a number of comorbidities, such as cardiac issues or respiratory issues, and therefore they wouldn't potentially make it into the trial. There's also a number of things around blood counts. So often to get into the trials, you need to have a high hemoglobin or a high platelet count. And many of the patients we see on our day-to-day basis may not have that level of bloods. And I think the third thing is the recovery of side effects. So potentially many of these clinical studies suggest that maybe patients with neuropathy can't go into them. And so there are actually a whole host of reasons why our myeloma patients sadly wouldn't be eligible for the trials. And that's why it's important that we do take a look at some of this real world evidence, because often it's the patient sat in front of us is maybe not quite that patient that might have been in the clinical trial.
That certainly has been my experience, unfortunately. It can be very difficult to enroll patients on clinical trials, and that does tend to exclude quite a few folks. So we've already talked about this a little bit, but could you outline some of the key strengths and limitations of real-world evidence in relation to day-to-day clinical practice and why it's important for clinicians to understand these strengths and limitations?
So I think one of the things we all automatically think about when we think of real-world evidence is that it's not controlled and therefore it's not of any use. And I think one of the potential weaknesses is that it's not controlled data, but that's also potentially one of its strengths in the fact that this real-world evidence does actually reflect that patient that sat in front of us. So maybe that older or that frailer patient, we can actually say, you know, how would our patient do compared to this general data rather than compared to the clinical trial? But I think there is some limitations. We often really from the data can't work out why a particular physician chose a treatment. It's not always clear whether they chose a particular treatment because of a previous side effect or a comorbidity, or indeed because the patient chose an oral versus an intravenous route. So there's those kind of limitations. But potentially some of the strengths may be that we actually get to see a little bit more of some of the side effects, particularly those side effects that really trouble patients and result in dose reductions or stopping the therapy. And also some of those long-term or unusual adverse events.
Yeah, I've got to tell you that a lot of the folks that I see would never fit on a clinical trial, mostly because of comorbidities. And though there are a few who in the Midwest where I practice live quite a long ways from the hospital, and they do prefer oral agents to IV agents. It's just much easier for them to not have to come in on such a regular basis. So those are definite limitations of the controlled trials, but things that we really have to take into account every day in practice. Now we'll turn to looking at real-world evidence on the treatment of elderly frail patients with myeloma. Both NCCN and ESMO have produced guidelines for first-line therapies for non-transplant patients. In each case, they have recommended bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, VRD, and daratumumab, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, or DARA-RD. And ESMO has additionally included a regimen with methylprednisolone, daratumumab, and bortezomib, which is not really used here in the States at all. But these would be first-line therapy for patients who were not candidates for aggressive therapy. There is some real-world evidence in how to treat elderly frail patients with myeloma. If they're newly diagnosed, you can certainly follow the NCCN or ESMO guidelines, but the data seems to indicate that first or second line regimens using bortezomib, lenalidomide, or thalidomide does improve outcomes in elderly patients compared with reserving their use for later lines of therapy. Ixazomib, an oral proteasome inhibitor, triplet therapies are also effective in these fragile elderly patients. NCCN has made stem cell transplantation a category 1 recommendation for upfront treatment of myeloma, but many patients over 70 years of age are not candidates. However, those that are can certainly undergo transplant safely and achieve very similar disease control benefits to those patients in their 60s. Transplant does result in a survival benefit for older patients, that is those over 65 years of age, versus no transplant, though that probably is a reflection of their comorbidities and general frailty. For patients with relapsed refractory myeloma, proteasome inhibitor triplet or monoclonal antibody therapies are effective and well-tolerated. There is a longer time to next treatment for intermediate frail patients with ixazomib or bortezomib compared with carfilzomib. And more patients that are over 75 years of age do receive ixazomib or bortezomib compared with carfilzomib or daratumumab triplets, likely on the basis of comorbidities. And finally, CAR T-cell therapy. This is the new kid on the block and is used quite heavily in patients with lymphomas and has just recently been approved for patients with myeloma who have failed 4 lines of therapy and been treated with most all of the available active agents. Unfortunately, a very small percentage of older patients are eligible for CAR T therapy, probably because by the time they get to their 5th line of therapy, they're really not in shape to undergo anything very aggressive. As this treatment is moved up in the treatment protocols and becomes more upfront, undoubtedly more older patients will be eligible for it. We'd now like to move to Dr. Davies. Faith, now you've had to hear me drone on for a few minutes. What does the real world evidence, as you're published in this area, tell us about the treatment of newly diagnosed myeloma patients who are elderly and frail.
So, Randy, I think it's really interesting because, as you say, for the NCCN guidelines, they suggest 3 drug regimens. But actually, when you go to the real world evidence, often for our elderly and frail patients, they're actually getting 2 drug regimens. And so that would suggest that we're potentially under-treating them a little bit, probably because we're concerned about side effects or their ability to tolerate the treatment. But I think what we've discovered when you go into the evidence a little bit more and look a little bit more carefully, that if you manage these patients well, that they can actually tolerate a 3-drug regimen. And as long as you're looking closely at the potential for side effects and monitoring them closely, that they can tolerate it and they actually do benefit from it. So I think what we need to take from our real world evidence is, as you said, that making sure our patients receive some of these newer therapies up front and that we shouldn't be saving them for later. And that if, wherever possible, using a 3-drug combination, but also making sure we manage those side effects appropriately.
So moving on, what does the real world evidence tell us about the treatment of relapse in refractory patients with myeloma who are elderly and frail?
So again, it's very interesting. The real world evidence suggests that regardless of the regimen we use, that elderly and frail patients tend to have a shorter progression-free survival and overall survival than those reported in the phase 3 randomized clinical trials. And they also tend to have some more side effects than those reported in the clinical trials. But importantly, these seem to be very manageable if the physician is really kind of looking out for them, particularly in the first few months of treatment. And I think one of the interesting things about the evidence is that it didn't really seem to matter which proteasome inhibitor was chosen. The patients seem to tolerate that proteasome inhibitor relatively well. Indeed, as we know, each of the proteasome inhibitors has slightly different side effect profile. So there's ixazomib, which is oral. There's the carfilzomib, which is intravenous. And then the bortezomib, which is both subcutaneous and intravenous. And each has slightly different side effect profile. And it seemed to be in the real world data that the elderly and frail patients particularly seem to get on very well with the oral combination, the ixazomib, lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And when patients received this, they seem to have a longer time to their next treatment.
Yeah, I find it's difficult to give carfilzomib to older patients in comparison to the other two. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, it can be. I think it's good that there's a number of different doses we can use. But I agree, one of the side effects for the carfilzomib can be problems with blood pressure and problems with cardiac failure. And clearly, many of our older patients will already have issues with these. And so it can sometimes be that we're kind of matching up those side effects. And I think that for me, sometimes that oral medication for my older, frailer patients is particularly useful because often they are relying on other people to bring them to the clinic for the infusions. And so just the pure practical side of things can be very useful with an oral medication.
Yeah, I find the oral agents are very popular amongst quite a few of my older patients, particularly, as I mentioned earlier, those that live a distance from our center. They really appreciate not having to be there twice a week to get something IV or sub-Q. And finally, how do you think real-world evidence should be interpreted and used in clinical practice, in particular for elderly and frail multiple myeloma patients?
Randy, I think it's really important that we do use it because we sometimes get concerned, I guess, that we're maybe not following the trial phase three protocol to the letter, and that we're potentially, I guess, under-treating or being quite aggressive with our therapy if we were to do that. And I think what the real-world evidence really shows us is that if we treat our older, frailer patient as an individual, and if we try to ensure that we're keeping a close eye on them, but doing that dose reduction, we can, if required, we can actually keep the patient on the therapy for a long time. And I think that's really what the real world evidence shows us, is that we can treat patients as an individual. We can, I guess it's the art of medicine. We can use those skills that we've developed over the years to really ensure that we can keep the patient on the therapy. We can manage their side effects. And that's the real way that the patients benefit from that treatment.
Yeah, we were speaking earlier about doublets and triplets. And do you find that you use doublets quite a bit in your older patients?
I actually, so sadly, old enough to have been around a wee while. And maybe 10 years ago, I used doublets an awful lot for my patients. But I've actually found now that many of those patients really can tolerate the triplet very well. If we do that kind of individualizing the therapy, and that actually our drugs now potentially don't have quite as many side effects as those older drugs we used to use. And therefore, I'm managing to give my patients those triplets and really kind of concentrating on improving their quality of life. And sometimes to begin with, that may be that we need to be a little bit more aggressive and look at them closely for those first month or two to get them over the hump, so and to get their disease under a little bit better control. Certainly often when we think about frailty, sometimes it's surprising how in after a month or two's therapy, the myeloma disease-related symptoms come down. And actually a patient's frailty can actually be a little less, and they're actually a little bit fitter once we've got their myeloma under control a bit.
I've certainly seen that. Do you lean towards antibody therapy, daratumumab, or more towards proteasome inhibitor therapy? And this is a purely opinion question, I realize.
Yeah. I think it's very much dependent on the patient. We come back down to this again. I think I definitely look at a patient's home circumstances, at their comorbidities, and at the side effects they've previously had from their therapy. So, for instance, clearly in an older, frailer patient, I need to be a little bit careful about neuropathy with respect to bortezomib. I may already be aware that their mobility is not so good, or that they have diabetes and already struggle with some neuropathy in their feet. And so I would potentially be thinking about not using bortezomib in those patients. But I think as a general rule, you're completely correct. I will go for either a PI or an antibody along with my IMiD. As I say, I don't think I have a set rule. I think it's very much dependent on that patient that sat in front of me and exactly what their circumstances are, how frequently they can come to hospital, and so on.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful information for me, certainly as I see patients on a daily basis. So I think now we'll move on. And we'll talk a little bit about the management of elderly frail patients with myeloma in clinical practice, and in particular, trying to understand how we assess frailty and how we deem that someone is frail or not in terms of trying to use that information for decision making. There are some very fancy definitions of frailty in terms of vulnerability to stressors because of a multi-system reduction in reserve capacity. But at the end of the day, it's present in about a third of patients with myeloma at the time of diagnosis that they are quite frail. There are a number of ways to measure that, including just simply performance status. Faith, let me ask you, how has the assessment of frailty in patients with myeloma evolved over time?
Yeah, so the way we think about frailty in myeloma patients has very much changed over the last 10 or 15 years. The initial frailty score that was introduced back in 2015 involved not only looking at a patient's comorbidities, but also looking at their general activities of daily living, and also incorporated their age. And that score split patients into three groups. So we had a fit group, a kind of intermediate group, and a frail group. And the important thing about that was that the PFS and OS was dependent on which group the patient fitted into, but also their side effects changed. And so those patients which were deemed fitter had less side effects than those patients who were deemed frail. But I think one of the issues or potential problems with that scoring system is that in the clinic, it was maybe a little cumbersome, and we weren't particularly used to assessing activities of daily living and using the Charlson Comorbidity Index. And so there's been a number of other kind of scoring systems that have come by since. And the one I kind of like to use is the simplified scoring system. And this really splits patients into two groups, a fit group and a frail group. And that is a little easier to deal with because it's very much more based on performance status and some of the comorbidities. But certainly one of the things we do have to look at is this activity of daily living. So essentially, when the patient comes to clinic, do they come on their own? Do they require a carer? How are they mobilizing? What about their mental status? Are they able to remember to take their medications? And so on and so forth. And I think taking all of those things into account is actually really important because it helps to guide us as to which is going to be the best treatment for patients. Just one of the other things, just as I'm thinking about it, one of the other problems with the initial scoring system was that patients who were over the age of 80 automatically got put into the frail box. And I think we all know many patients who are over the age of 80 who, yes, are frail, but also we know many patients over the age of 80 who are actually relatively fit. And so I think that's why it's important that we do utilize both our comorbidities and some of these kind of more basic features of everyday life to judge which is the most appropriate therapy for our patients.
So how would you advise me as a clinician out in the real world to use a frailty scoring system to aid in the treatment decision-making process? And we're running into this a little bit in the stem cell transplant area because we've just really started assessing frailty and found that quite a number of our patients are much frailer than we dreamed they were just by looking at them. So when this older myeloma patient walks through the door and one of my partners wants me to tell them, is this person going to be fit to go through an aggressive treatment program? How can I use these scoring systems to help me with that decision making?
Yeah, no, it's interesting, isn't it? Because despite the fact that I am very much for these frailty scores, I still feel inside that I'm much better at judging a patient's frailty than adding up the numbers on a piece of paper, which is maybe not the right thing to say. But I think it's an important exercise because for me, particularly in our older, frailer patients, we really need to think about what our starting therapy doses are going to be. For instance, what dose of dexamethasone do we want to start the patient on? Or what dose of the proteasome do we want to start the patient on? And how frequently are we going to give the treatment? And also, how frequently are we going to touch base with the patient to monitor their side effects? Because I think one of the important things we learned is that if we go in too hard, then the patient, unfortunately, can get a lot of side effects, have to come off therapy. And then when they're off therapy, their disease can advance quite quickly. Whereas sometimes if we actually go in a little bit gentler and build up, we can keep the patient on the therapy and they can actually get benefit from the therapy. And there's a really interesting paper from one of our Italian colleagues who looked at reducing the doses of treatment and found that patients actually did much better if the doses came down a little bit, because they could tolerate it and they could stay on that therapy for a little bit longer. So in my own practice, what I do is I definitely chat with the patient to find out how they cope around the home and what their mobility is like, what their diet is like, what other comorbidities they have, and what help they require. And that helps me to then decide exactly how I should go in with my therapies.
Makes sense. It does become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you're unable to treat the patient as to how they're going to come out. And finally, thinking about treatment personalization, what other factors other than what's in a frailty scoring system should we be looking at? You know, we get performance status, we get ADLs, but what else is out there that we need to be asking about or questioning our patients about or their caregivers with respect to figuring out the best way to treat them?
So I think for me, there's two important areas here. One is what the patient is wanting from their treatment. So what are their expectations and what side effects, stroke, interruption to everyday life are they going to be comfortable with taking on board? And as we chatted about earlier, are we going for an IV, an oral, a subcutaneous? How frequently do they need to come to clinic? Because as with any patient, but particularly with our older and frailer patients, we need to ensure that we're all on the same page and that we all have the same aims of what our therapy should do. I think it's also important that in our younger, potentially fitter patients, we know that the cytogenetic abnormalities play a particularly important role. But actually, there's now a number of studies to suggest in our older, frailer patients that it's actually the frailty that kind of trumps those cytogenetic abnormalities. So although patients may have high-risk cytogenetics when we look at them, it's actually the frailty score that actually plays a more prominent role in their treatment moving forward. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be looking at the cytogenetics, but I do think that we do need to be kind of thinking about our frailty score and exactly what the patient wishes their therapy to achieve.
Yeah, I've got to go along with you there. I think that understanding what our patients want at the end of the day, particularly in an older patient with an incurable disease, is really critically important in trying to decide how appropriately to treat them and how much we're going to impact their life and their lifestyle with our treatments. Thank you very much. This has been a delightful discussion, certainly very educational for me, and I hope for our audience. I think that's all we have to tell you today. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com.